reminded of what Olene said so often as she was especially coming down toward the end of her life. Her phrase was, I don't know what I'd do without Jesus. I don't know what I would do without Jesus. And that's just how I feel this morning. Amen. In the 5th century AD, the Romans still ruled pretty much the known world, but their rule was coming to an end. And they left the Isle of Great Britain, where they had occupied for many years. Saxons invaded. It was a pretty rough time for England. Finally, the Saxons eventually raided and then settled there, integrated into the native culture. And so the Anglo-Saxons then become those in that area, that live in that area. Several centuries later, the historian Nennius, I guess that's how to pronounce his name, wrote in his history about an English king named Arthur and told about all these battles he'd been involved in. Well, the problem was there was no way one man could have been in all the battles that Nennius said Arthur was involved in. But he told of King Arthur, and then as time went on, other writers picked up on the story and expanded on it. And we now have the legend of King Arthur. Today, scholars really don't know whether Arthur was a genuine person or strictly a legend. But they certainly agree that whatever the reality in history was, that the legend has far outrun the reality. That's the same view, honestly, that many secular historians have taken and some still take of King David. That, yeah, there probably was may have been a tribal chieftain named David, and others say, no, David he was a later invention. It didn't even exist. Several years ago, 1993, one of the unusual times in history when archaeology picks up something that is really directly tied to Scripture, archaeologists found this inscription written by an enemy king a century after David's death, and refers to Judah as the House of David in this ancient inscription. Well, if 100 years later they're still referring to a nation as the House of something, that person was incredibly important in the founding of that country. We don't even call America the House of Washington, all right? We don't use that phrase. So this inscription confirms what so many secular historians denied for many, many years, that David was, in fact, a genuine king, a founder, one of the great founders of the nation of Israel, nation of Judah at the time. His path to the throne was very well known, of course. Many stories of David and Goliath. He was the warrior hero of Israel. But, of course, his popularity made King Saul, who was weak and afraid and very defensive, made King Saul literally insanely jealous. And so he spent several years running from Saul. Once Saul died, then you have a divided kingdom. We think of the divided kingdom later in history, but you have the divided kingdom even early on. The tribe of Judah made David king. The northern tribes made Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, king. And so for 7 years, David reigns in Judah from Hebron. Eventually, the rest of the tribes came together. Ish-bosheth is killed, and there's lots of infighting. Finally, they all come together and say, David, you were the one who led us in and out. In other words, you were the captain. You were the practical leader of Israel, even while Saul was still alive. So we want you to be king over all of Israel, all 12 tribes, not just Judah. So they come, they proclaim him king, and he's confirmed as king of united Israel. Well, the problem is his capital in Hebron is central to Judah. But just by declaring someone king over an entire nation doesn't make that nation suddenly mend, right? It's still divided. There's still lots of hostilities, especially when there's been civil war between the two halves. So David, being a wise man, realizes he needs a new capital. So he comes, he looks around, and he sees the fortress of Jebus. We know now as Jerusalem. You notice probably some reasons he chooses this. It is right on the border between Judah and the rest of Israel. It's fairly central. It's still in Judah, so it's still in territory that strongly supports him, but it's on the border between Judah and Benjamin, the rest of Israel. So he's, you can see his strategy here in choosing this location for his new capital in Jerusalem. The problem was Jerusalem was not under Israeli or Israelite rule. It was still a stronghold of the old Canaanites, the Jebusites, that had never been fully driven out. They had somewhat earlier, but never fully driven out, and then the Jebusites took back over the city. There is still a Canaanite stronghold right in the middle of Israel. And it's a powerful city. It's a fortress, literally. It's strong enough that when David comes against it, the Jebusites start taunting him. They literally say, we could defend this city with the blind and the lame, and you couldn't get in here. And David kind of turns out against them in this story. And he says, okay, anyone that will go kill the blind and the lame, you'll be the captain. All right, so he uses blind and the lame as a sarcastic reference to his enemies. Some have taken this to be this phrase to mean that David hated anyone who was disabled. That's not the idea at all. It was turning this taunt back on his enemies. So he comes, and let me indulge a little imagination a minute. I can just imagine David saying, okay, I need a capital. I need a capital that's more central to the whole country. And that would be perfect. But the enemy is still there, right? But he knows that God gave Israel all of Canaan. So he says, okay, they're in my city. I want that city. God says I can have that city, but they're in my city. And so it's not just, you have two things going on with David. Many times through his life, you have this strategy, this young man, who is very driven, not necessarily in a bad way, very, very ambitious, very action-oriented, a bias for action, if you will. It's a little odd phrase, overused in business sometimes. But he's going to go get something done, all right? He's the guy that when he's watching the sheep, he's also practicing with his slingshot, which is actually a weapon back then. It was actually a very powerful weapon. So he's out, everybody overlooks him. He's out watching the sheep. But he's training himself to be a warrior instead of saying, well, I'm just a shepherd. I can't do anything. So he's this guy who all his life is pushing his limits. He's pushing himself, but he's also trusting God. It's rare to find someone who has that balance of I'm fully trusting God. I'm not going to push myself ahead of God. And yet I'm going to push myself to develop as much as I possibly can. Fascinating balance in David through his life. But he comes to the Jebusite capital, or city, not its capital, their territory, to the fortress of Jebus, and they say, go away. We could defend this thing with blind men, and you wouldn't get in here. Well, the problem, and that was almost true, because it was very well fortified. It was built on a mountain. Strong walls had never fallen. The problem was that, the problem to the Jebusites at least, what they didn't think about was this. You have the city of Jebus, but the spring for the city is outside the city walls. So they actually built an extension, a citadel, to guard the spring of Gihon, which is how the city got its water. The water from the spring just outside the city walls at the base of the hill flowed underground underneath the city, and there was a 40-foot, basically a well, a 40-foot shaft in the rock that they could lower buckets down just like in a well and get water that way. So they didn't have to go out of the city to get their water. But there was this way in that David knew about, apparently, because he sent a party into that spring, waded through that water, and then climbed that vertical shaft up into the city, and fought their way through I'm not going to lie to you, they were old enough to know they got in there and opened the gates on the inside, let it, and suddenly, you know, their defenses are gone. Their gates are open. And David and his army comes in and defeats them. Joab is then confirmed as the leader of David's army, the commander-in-chief, because he's the first one through. Samuel, 2 Samuel doesn't tell about that, but 1 Chronicles has a parallel passage. It gives more detail. And so he works his way in by strategy into this fortress and defeats the enemies and takes over the forces of Jebus, also known as the stronghold of Zion. Zion was the name of the mountain. And renames it Jerusalem. It becomes known as the city of David. It's a fascinating thing right there, because think about it. God says, he tells us later, he chose Jerusalem to put his name there. Now, the Jews will tell you there is literally the hills and the valleys at Jerusalem sits on, literally has the Hebrew letter of the first name of for God. So they will say God's name is literally, physically in the mountains on that Jerusalem sits on. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. How far you want to take that, I don't know. I guess suspicious of too many things that are too wow factor. But the fact is that God did say, I chose Jerusalem to put my name there, my temple there. David had no idea of that. We have no indication that David knew that this was going to be a world capital. I'm certain David had no idea that when new creation comes and God remakes the entire world, the capital will be the new Jerusalem. David didn't know that. He just knew, I need a city. I need a capital. God said, that's mine. They've got it. I want it. All right? Let's go get it. We don't know what God is going to do with what we do. But here's something I have to remind myself of, to be very honest with you. Actions bring results. We can plan, and we need to plan. David had a plan. We can dream. We can think, right? Have great intentions. And those are necessary. But if we never get to acting, nothing happens. Actions are what brings results. I love to dream. I love to plan. I love to think about how to do things and so on. And sometimes I have to tell myself, you know what? You can plan all you want, but if you don't do anything, nothing's going to happen. There'll be a plan and nothing else. Actions are what bring results. And God blesses David's actions. He's working in faith and yet very much pushing himself as he does it. So he has this strong capital now, this fortress that he's now solidified and actually made stronger, built more of the wall. And it says, David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. So to the north of Israel is the Phoenician Empire, ruled by Tyre, or the city of Tyre. And Hiram, king of Tyre, who is Israel's neighbor to the north. He recognizes a growing power in Israel. He recognizes David is building something and going somewhere. He says, I want him on my side. All right, I need to have an ally in this guy, because if he's not my ally, he could come wipe me out, essentially. And so he sends to David and says, I'm going to build you a palace. You're a powerful king. You got to have a palace that matches. So the Phoenicians the area around Tyre and Sidon are known for their cedar trees and their woodwork and their craftsmen. So he sends the materials and the craftsmen to build a palace for David. He's solidifying an ally here. So he does this. David is powerful. He's growing in power. The Philistines are becoming fearful. And they decide to come against him. He wipes them out. I don't spend time there, but you got two times the Philistines get together and say, hey, we got to stop this guy, because you see the Philistines are just over next to the sea, and they're trying to stop David, and twice he wipes them out. So they're still there, but they're not much of a threat for quite a while after David gets through with them. So David is now at peace. He's defeated his enemies. He has a either in the process or finished a phenomenal for the first day, a phenomenal palace built by the master craftsmen in the world. These are the men from Tyre and Sidon who know very, very well what they're doing. And they're the top craftsmen. And so things are good for David, right? Times of peace can be dangerous or they can be very, very good. David isn't done. He wants the ark in Jerusalem as well. The ark, if you remember, think back, the ark was captured by the Philistines. Remember, and they sent it all over the place, and they get plagues for mistreating God's ark, basically mistreating God, and so they send it back to Israel, and it's just put in a guy's house and stays there. And Eleazar is taking care of it. Abinadab is the man who was watching the ark for 20 years. The ark is just in this guy's house, being cared for, of course, being tended to, but it's just there. David says, you know what? This capital needs not only to be the political capital, it needs to be the religious capital. Again, God has not yet chosen a place for the temple to be built. This is the process by which God chooses it. But the ark doesn't have a certain place it has to be. So David says, I want to bring the ark to Jerusalem. And so they come together and go down to where the ark is and in order to bring it up to Jerusalem. The problem is, either David was impatient, or maybe he didn't really do enough research. For whatever reason, he puts the ark on an ox cart. Now, again, the 20 years before, the ark had been in the Philistine hands. It was sent back to Israel, remember that story, on an ox cart. The Philistines said, well, we'll put it on the cart. We'll see if there really is God doing this or not, or if it's just coincidence that these plagues and problems are happening. And so they put it on a cart. They take two oxen that have just given birth with young calves, take the calves away from them, and say, okay, if this is God, God will direct them back where he wants them to go. Naturally, these cows are going to want to go back to their calves. And yet God brings them back into Israelite territory. Maybe David's remembering that story as God working through the ox cart. I don't know. For whatever reason, he takes the ark on a cart like it had been previously and brings it to Jerusalem that way. Okay? So he's not really following God's directed commands here on how to move the ark. So, we know this story. As they're coming around this man's threshing floor, it says the oxen stumble, there's a rough place in the road, and the cart is jostled, and Uzzah puts his hand out to steady the ark. Well, that's, God has very clearly said, you never touch the ark. Only the Levites touch the handles to carry it, period. No one else ever touches this ark. And so God immediately, kills Uzzah for breaking this very strong command. We know that story. That kind of puzzles us. It's one we don't like that much because, as far as we know, Uzzah was trying to help. He wasn't trying to be rebellious. Personally, I don't think the fact that God killed him there reflects on his spiritual condition. You may disagree with that. But I think it had to be something God had to make clear. Okay, you don't treat my ark the way the Philistines did. You know, they're pagan. They didn't know what they're doing. You do. You don't treat my ark the same way they did. I don't think God judged him as far as his relationship with the Lord. We don't know what he was like anyway. But it was a clear, visible judgment to Israel saying, you treat the ark and by extension treat me properly. But here's something you never really noticed when you go on here. Verse 8 and 9. And David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah, which means the breach of Uzzah, the place that God broke out against Uzzah. To this day, so David was afraid of the Lord that day. So David's reaction to this is anger and fear. Now, it doesn't say he's angry at God or angry at himself for making the mistake that cost this man his life or what. But we're pretty sure that David's reaction was not right here. So David's made some pretty serious errors here. David messes up pretty good. In fact, as you know, there's a number of times that David messes up. Guess what? You don't have to be perfect to do something for God. There's always a reason not to act. There's a proverb that says, "If he who watches the clouds will never sow." In other words, if you just wait to the perfect opportunity to do things, you're not going to do anything. I have a story, I don't have time for it, but I'll give you a really short version. Put in a little paver patio back in South Carolina. And you had to seal, the customer wanted it sealed with a sealant that would make it look wet, so it looked a lot better, but also kept it from decaying and deteriorating and so on. Well, the sealant had to be dry to put the sealant on. So I watched the weather. There was always like 3 days out chance of thunderstorms all summer long. It was the driest summer we'd had in years. All summer, I said, I can't do it yet because there's possible rain before it's going to be fully cured. So through the driest summer we had, I just didn't do it because it was possibility of... I finally just went ahead and did, and it was fine. Honestly, it's kind of anticlimactic ending there. But if we watch too closely for the perfect opportunity, nothing happens. David messed up big time with the ark. He messed up big time other times. Time of peace can be dangerous. There was a time, we know there was a time that it was another time of peace, and he doesn't do anything in that time. He goes into Bathsheba and ends up killing her husband and having a baby with her, or she has a baby by him. David was not perfect. If we want to wait until God has us fully perfect, 100% straightened out with no errors left, no flaws left, we're not going to do anything. If we act, if we do something for God, we may make mistakes. God will use those mistakes. There's always a reason not to act. Why are we waiting? What are we waiting for? And I include myself right there with that. What are we waiting for if we're not... We should do this eventually. Okay, why eventually? Why not now? If there's a genuine reason not to, it's fine. But if it's just kind of a matter that there'll be a better time down the road, there's always a reason not to act. So eventually, 3 months later, so they take the ark to a man's house again, and after 3 months they realize God is blessing this man. He's not angry with us for messing with the ark. Then they do it right. They bring it to Jerusalem. There's an incredible celebration as they bring the ark into Jerusalem, and I'm rushing through here, I know. I'm just assuming you know most of the stories. But as they come into Jerusalem and the ark is there, David has prepared a special tent for the ark. He's been in a tent this whole life. The ark doesn't have a life. Okay, fine. It's been in a tent the entire existence, all right? And David has prepared a special tent for it there in Jerusalem, and they bring it into the tent. And there's this incredible celebration. And David goes back home, it says, to his house of cedar. And he says, that's not right. I have this house of cedar of incredible craftsmanship, of the most expensive materials, and God's ark is in a tent. What's wrong with his picture? And so he goes to Nathan, the prophet, and says, is it okay to build a temple? And Nathan says, go for it. And then has to come back after and say, I got that wrong. God said, no. A little humbling there. But you can see, David's a dreamer. David's a man of action, but he's a man of dreams as well. He needs a capital. Let's go get the one that's the best one, whether it's easy or not. How is it right that I live in a house of cedar and the ark lives in a tent? It dwells in a tent. What lives? What's with this? The ark is in a tent. There, as we've mentioned and we've talked about, there's a lot of people right now who are having a tough time. All right? Not everyone is. Life is tough sometimes. Life is pretty smooth sometimes. The tough times are times that deepen us, that help us walk with God, that trust God more. The time of peace is also a time that's dangerous. And yet it can be a very good time, a time of peace. One thing peace is for recovery, but another thing it's for is for dreaming. If you this morning, honestly, sometimes just taking the next step is the victory, all right? Just putting one foot in front of another and making it through another day, that can be a victory. And if that's where you are this morning, don't beat yourself up because you're not accomplished. Don't feel like you're accomplishing much, all right? Staying true to God is a major accomplishment sometimes. We remember Job not for what he did, but for simply the fact that he stayed true to God. But if that's not you this morning, if this morning life is pretty good, life is pretty smooth, it's a time of peace, it's a time of enjoying God's blessing, let me ask you this. What are you doing with that? Don't waste your peace, all right? One thing peace is for dreaming. What might God want me to do? What is there I can do for God? And so we see David at peace, things are good, his dreams are fulfilled, he's looking for something else to do. He's a dreamer and a doer. So he says, I want to build a temple. And Nathan says, go ahead. And then comes back the next morning and says, God talked to me last night. And he says, no, you don't build your temple. But he says, you can, what you do, essentially, God tells him, no, you collect materials. You put the materials together. You put the plans together. Later in 1 Chronicles 28, it says God says that David gave Solomon all the everything he put together for the temple, and you can read through the list, an incredible, incredible amount of stuff. He got gold and all kinds of precious materials and building materials. But he also, and I'd never really noticed this before, he also gave him the plans. David designed the temple. We call it Solomon's temple because Solomon built it, but David designed the thing. David collected everything together. So God basically said, okay, David, you don't get to build it, but do all the prep work. And David said, no, I'm not doing that unless my name's on it. Right? No, David said, okay, I'll do what I can. And it's, we don't think of it as David's temple. And yet it was David's life's work that made it possible. But David wasn't worried about getting his name on it, being known, but he wanted to do what he could for God's glory. When God said, no, you can't, don't go this, don't do that, don't actually build it, but do all the prep work, all the behind-the-scenes stuff, your son's going to build it, and he'll get the glory from it. He didn't say that, but that's the way we humanly were tempted to think of it, right? David was okay with that. So David gets all the materials together, he gets a plan together, and gives it to Solomon, and Solomon puts it together. But here's a fascinating thing. God basically says to David, no, you're not building me a house. I'm going to build you a house. God blesses David for what he planned and what he intended and what he wanted to do, even though he didn't allow him to do it. I'm not quite sure what to do with that. So I don't want to say it only matters what we plan, not what we do, because that's not scriptural. But the intent is what God looks at. So let's not set aside anything that God uses action, but God looks at intent. So God says to back in 2 Samuel 7, God says to David, why do you want to build me a house? I didn't ask you to. The ark's always stayed in the tent. Basically, he says, it's not necessary. Thanks, but no thanks. But he goes on to say, instead of you building me a house, I'm going to build you a house, a dynasty. And he goes on to say, I will, your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever, and your throne will be established forever. And we know the only way that happens and the fulfillment of that is Jesus Christ. When the angel speaks to Mary, he says he will be on the throne of his the God has given him, there we go, the throne of his father David. And David's throne thus becomes a symbol for the rule of Jesus Christ, the eternal rule of Jesus Christ. So get this picture. Here's David. It's peaceful. Things have worked out. Things are good. He's far from a perfect man. We see that over and over, several times in his life. He makes some major, major blunders, major sins. He's far from perfect in the English sense of the word perfect. But he takes this time of plenty and of peace to say, I want to do something for God. He has big dreams. I want to build you a house. And God says, no, actually, I'm going to build you a house. When we work for God's glory, we find God's blessing. And even when our plans don't work, David planned to build it. God said, no, you're not going to build it. Even when our plans don't work, God still works on our behalf for us. When we're willing to say, I'm going to do something for God, I'll do my best not to mess up, but if I do, I'm going to get up and try again and learn from it and do better. God works behind the scenes. God does stuff for us that we have not yet dreamed of. When we're willing to step up and say, I'm doing something for him, when we work for God's glory, even if our plans don't work as we intend, God still works and blesses us in what we do. David's a man of action. He's this incredible balance between trusting God and getting it done. Very practical, hands-on, kind of redneck kind of guy. Let's just get this thing done. And yet, every step is in faith. Take that back. Not every step's in faith. What he does is in faith, with some exceptions. He's far from perfect, as we said. But he stands as a pattern of what God can do in us, through us. When we're going to walk with him, we don't let our failures knock us down. And he calls us to action. What are we doing for God this morning? Let's stand. Be dismissed.